The Guardian.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for April the 7th. Coming up on this week's show, as British scientists create the country's first human-animal hybrid embryos, we hear from Doug Melton of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. Doug tells us everything you wanted to know about stem cells, but didn't have an expert around to ask. Also in the show...
If you compare this system with the current practice of keyhole surgery, you see some tremendous advantages.
A robotic surgeon that helps during operations by preempting the doctor. Plus...
Since then, I realised that it was unfair of me to not tell them to stick it up their ass, because it's not just me.
Science in regional accents. It's all coming up in Science Weekly from The Guardian. Happy Monday, listeners. Now, you know me.
I'm an oil man, and this is my son, HW. We've come to prospect podcasting gold.
Nah, not really. I am here with The Guardian's tech correspondent and officially the hardest working man in the podcast universe, though, Bobby Johnson. Bobby, are you an oil man?
I'm an oily man.
Have you seen There Will Be Blood?
I haven't, no, but I believe Daniel Day-Lewis is very actorly in it.
He is, yeah. You wouldn't even got my reference then. Well, anyway.
No, it means nothing to me.
Last week, scientists at Newcastle University created Britain's first human-animal hybrid embryos. It comes after many weeks of political debate about the ethics of such research. And this week, we'll see the UK National Stem Cell Network meet for its inaugural conference. The potential of stem cells is often lost amongst the many political and ethical discussions people have, so we thought we'd step back and give you the ultimate guide to the science. Advocates of the work argue that they could be used to investigate debilitating and so far untreatable conditions such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's and motor neurone disease. But what about the science beyond that? I went to meet probably the world's leading scientist in this field. Doug Melton is the co-director of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, and last year he was listed amongst Time magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. His lab is leading the way in this pioneering research. He told me more about what they're up to, in particular, research to reprogram skin cells.
I'm very impressed by an experiment done decades ago by the British biologist John Gurdon, who famously, as you may know, cloned frogs. And one of the things that shows is that all of the cells in your body still retain within them the potential to make all other kinds of cells. The reprogramming to which you referred is an example of that, of taking a skin cell and making a stem cell. But one should not forget that it's also therefore possible to take a skin cell and go directly into any other kind of cell. You might not have to go back to a pluripotent stem cell. You may be able to take a skin cell and turn it straight into a muscle cell. Now, of course, the trouble is you might also turn it into a fat cell, and you might say, well, I don't need more fat. But the exciting part of this stem cell biology and reprogramming is understanding the kind of program, like a computer program, that tells cells what they should be. And that potential is why you see so many papers in the journals these days. I would even go so far to say is if we were to think back to the 1950s and the discovery of DNA as a double helix and then the cloning of genes which came from that, that led to a flood and an expansion of papers in genetics, in developmental genetics and human genetics. We're now living in a period where stem cells are becoming the sort of epicenter for much of modern biology because they're teaching us and they're providing us the tools to understand how the genome is used to make all the different kinds of cells in the body, and at the same time hold out this prospect for regenerative medicine. And I think we tend to think too much about just disease. There's another aspect of biology which I think we're all interested in, which I would just call healthy aging. It's slowing the process of aging and living a healthy life. So this is for people who aren't suffering from a disease, but to ask the question, how could I use information about my body's inherent capacity to renew and repair to make me just age more happily and healthily?
Can I touch on one other slightly controversial issue that sort of people who have concerns about stem cells and particularly embryonic stem cells raise from time to time? For some people, the idea of cloning embryos is dangerous territory. In stem cell research, the idea would be to clone an embryo
to grow it for 10 or 14 days so that you can extract stem cells and then mm-hmm. use them for research. This idea of therapeutic cloning rather than reproductive cloning, right. which would be to grow them. Now, there's no one is suggesting that any serious scientist wants to clone a human being, but what is your argument against people who say this type of work should be absolutely banned?
Well, I think that people's concerns about cloning, as you described it, is not really cloning cells, which is what we're doing, making copies of cells, but is, as you indicated, the possibility of making a copy of a person. That's a metaphysical question about whether it's a bad idea to have a genetic copy of another person, and we're certainly not doing that kind of research. I wouldn't even call it research. That's not a goal of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, is to clone people reproductively. If people object to that research, it must relate to their decision or their opinion on when personhood begins. I think that must be the reason. And it's not a concern of the Institute because, as I say, we're not trying to do reproductive cloning. Maybe I'm being unfair because maybe your question is, well, does the Institute here plan to do cloning of human cells using somatic cell nuclear transfer? And the answer is yes, we do. The reason for that in the first instance is the same reason one did studies on infertility, which have gone so well in England. And that is, we're interested in trying to find new treatments for degenerative disease. So I would suggest to you that if it's all right to mix sperm and eggs and to create cells in order to treat the disease or the condition of infertility, then it should certainly be all right to transfer nuclei to try to find new treatments for diabetes, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, muscular dystrophy.
Doug Melton, co-director of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute there. More from him later in the show. And if you want to listen to my full half-hour conversation with Dr. Melton, we've put the full interview up on the site as this week's Science Extra. Go to guardian.co.uk/science. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come?
No, didn't drop your dot all on the proggy map.
Would you trust this voice? We explore science in regional accents. First, though, here are some of the other science stories that have been making headlines over the past 7 days. Here's Bobby and producer Ben with your news jam.
News jam.
Gordon Brown intends to tighten the penalties for cannabis possession despite a clear recommendation by the government's own drug experts that it should remain a Class C drug. The Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs took its decision in private after a presentation of new unpublished research which suggested that schizophrenia has actually decreased in recent years despite fears that increased cannabis use was triggering more cases of the disease.
Short-term fasting could help protect cancer patients against the effects of chemotherapy, a study suggests. Scientists found that going without food toughens up healthy cells but not cancer cells, raising hopes that, if the finding can be confirmed in clinical trials, it could be used to improve cancer treatment.
Two leading scientific societies and a charity that promotes scientific understanding have written to every local education authority in the UK to warn that a programme of exercises being promoted to help child learning relies on pseudo-scientific explanations and a bizarre understanding of how the body works. They say brain gym undermines science teaching.
And finally, someone with a Brummy accent is considered less intelligent than someone who says nothing at all, according to researchers. After playing recordings of female voices to volunteers, the Yorkshire twang came top of the perceived brainy stakes, with received pronunciation close behind.
Thank you, Ben and Bobby. Now, Bobby, help me out with some of these. Tell us a bit more about this research into fasting. I mean, it comes after a long line of work from this chap, Valter Longo. Tell us a bit more about it all.
Yeah, Valter is a biomedical gerontologist at the University of Southern California. In the past, he's shown that if you restrict the calorific intake of worms and mice, you can extend their lives by up to about 40%. Now, what they found in this case is if you restrict calorie intake in mice, you can boost the chance of successful chemotherapy. Effectively, what you do is improve the kind of the health of the healthy cells and leave the cancer cells more vulnerable to, or not more vulnerable to chemo, but there'll be less damage on the healthy cells. So you can kind of effectively target the cancer cells. Part of this is because basically cells that are starved of food go into a kind of hibernation mode.
Yeah, I suppose evolutionarily speaking, you're thinking, well, there's no food around, so I've got to survive somehow, so stop doing all the unnecessary things and just live.
Exactly. So the real question is, you know, okay, we can see this happening in lower order organisms, but could you transfer this over to a person? There's no real sign that that could happen. But, you know, we can always
see.
We
get quite excited, actually, in newspapers about this sort of work. I mean, I know that Ian and I have written lots of stories in the past about Valter Longo's work, including when he extended the lives of yeast, actually, by about 10 times.
Now, lives of yeast. They must have really enjoyed that.
Yeast cells live, I don't know, not very long. And
but they
he made them live
hard.
Slightly less long.
Yeah.
And by mimicking a sort of caloric restriction. In this particular case, what struck me was that the healthy cells were something like 1,000 times better protected than cancer cells in these caloric restricted mice. And I mean, that's incredible numbers. I mean, even if you get a tenth of that or a hundredth of that into humans, then you could do amazing things with chemotherapy.
Yeah, I mean, precisely. This is always the interesting thing about his research, is if you could pass it across from the other organisms he's tested in into humans, it could be fantastic. But, you know, you always have to ask, well, OK, if calorific intake increases lifespan for whatever reason, then, you know, why is it actually that Western people who have kind of large diets and eat far too much, you know, why do they live longer than people elsewhere in the world? And it's, you know, basically what we have to look at is there's a huge complex set of variables that are involved in how long you live, and, you know, maybe just skipping the Mars bars isn't going to be the thing that keeps you living forever.
Absolutely. I'm glad that on this podcast we've decided that humans are more complex than mice and yeast, because I think that needs to be said. Especially to Valter. Valter, your work is not necessarily going to translate to us. Well, anyway, the brain gym thing was something that interested me. I saw this story. The brain gym is a sort of a system which involves, you know, kids sort of trying to improve the structure of their brains, apparently. And according to some of the material in the Teacher's Guide to Brain Gym, it's a system that can connect circuits to the brain, unblock neural pathways. And, you know, it sounds like nonsense to me. I mean, Ben Goldacre in his Bad Science columns brought this up quite a few times. Anyway, last week it seems that the British Neuroscience Association, the Physiological Society and Sense About Science, that charity that sort of promotes good science, they all wrote to all these local education authorities and said, look, guys, this is clearly nonsense. Don't use it. You're wasting your money. It's all based around pseudoscience. So, you know, even Colin Blakemore, who formerly of the Medical Research Council, was quoted as saying, I mean, I know of no evidence to support the claim that by doing particular repetitive activity, children will gain benefits in learning. He says that there have been few peer-reviewed scientific studies into the methods of brain gym, and none of them have found significant improvement in general academic skills. I mean, Bobby, lots of people do things like Sudokus and crosswords to improve their brain function and so on. But, you know, surely we've just got to take this stuff as sort of a side thing, really, not make some sort of formal training mechanism that's clearly not
exactly. I think this is what brain gym uses, is the kind of the common sense idea that, you know, maybe if you muck around with a crossword, you know, it's an exercise for the brain that you might not be doing otherwise. And, you know, that's kind of common sense. And, you know, it's like if a kid does sums, they might get better at sums in the long term. Obvious. You know, that's called practice. However,
there is a difference.
Yeah, it's the layer of kind of scientific babble that goes out with brain gym that kind of implies that it does something over and above what these normal practice routines would do anyway, that actually people do buy into. You know, I've spoken to teachers, I've spoken to people who go, oh yeah, this thing's fantastic, it realigns
it's
your cerebral
shocking.
Doobie-doo.
It's shocking.
You know, and actually I think we have to accept that teachers aren't necessarily, you know, like they're just ordinary people, and we have to make sure that they're imparting the right information, because the ultimate danger is if the kids believe that somehow they're super people because they're doing brain gym, then we're just breeding a whole kind of scientific illiteracy into a new generation.
But what about those games like on the Nintendo DS and so on that sell themselves on
improving your brain. I mean, I know that Sense About Science had some problems with that as well. These games are really popular, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, you know, millions of people buy them. 4 million people have a DS in Britain, and most of them have one of these brain training games. The thing is, it's going to be better than not doing anything at all. And so they're able to position themselves as saying, well, you know, if you sat on your fat bippy all day and didn't do anything, then yeah, this is brain exercise. But, you know, actually, maybe if you did reading or something, it's just as good.
Or listening to this podcast, which sounds lot of people much cleverer. Now, speaking of bad science, producer Ben's very limited attention span was well and truly grabbed this week by a study that apparently showed that people seem to match regional accents with perceived levels of intelligence. Apparently, people in Birmingham come out quite badly, giving an even worse impression of their intelligence than when they keep their mouth shut. But people with Yorkshire accents, as you heard, should talk as much as possible because you lot were rated the most intelligent sounding, beating, says the press release, the clipped vowels and precise diction of what is popularly known as the Queen's English. Now, scientists from Bath Spa University carried out research, but we've decided to conduct our own version of the study. Here are the real and imagined vocal talents of some of our colleagues at The Guardian reading out some proper bits of science. What you have to do is tell us who you believe the most.
Hey, on me, Doc. This is Andy from Nottingham. The change in the internal energy of a closed thermodynamic system is equal to the sum of the amount of heat energy supplied to the system and the work done on the system.
How are you, lads? It's Scott from Newcastle. The second law of thermodynamics is about entropy. The total entropy of any isolated thermodynamic system tends to increase over time, approaching a maximum value.
Are you having fun yet, listeners? Let's move to Newton's laws of motion.
All right, it's James from Yorkshire here. An object will stay at rest or continue at a constant velocity unless acted upon by an external unbalanced force.
I'm Ellie from North London. Observed from an inertial reference frame, the net force on a particle is proportional to the time rate of change of its linear momentum.
All right, this is Dave from Dudley. Whenever a particle I exerts a force on another particle B, B simultaneously exerts a force on I with the same magnitude in the opposite direction. Oh, fancy that. Who would have thought it?
Well, those are all absolutely brilliant. Bobby, you're kind of a sort of a reformed yokel. Do you want to do your most brilliant accent?
I have to say, I'm not a reformed yokel. My family are from Suffolk and Cambridgeshire, but there's nothing at all.
Do you want to say some science in that accent, please?
I don't know any science. You've lifted... I'm like say the bloody Wizard of Oz. You've just pulled the curtain down and here I am. I can't...
Say stem cells or something like that.
Stem cells...
I don't know. I don't believe you. Well, anyway, tell us, listeners, what you think over at the Science Blog. That's blogs.guardian.co.uk/science, or post a comment on our Facebook wall. Also, feel free to remind producer Ben what real science is.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
How do you feel about the idea of a robot operating on you? Using machines isn't new to surgery, but British researchers are now developing a way for their robot friends to get even better by working out a surgeon's intentions in advance during an operation. The work is a development of something called Da Vinci, which is already the most advanced robotic surgeon on the market. The human surgeon sits at a viewing console and directs the movements of the robot's mechanical arms inside the patient's body. In the new version, the surgeon's eye movements help control the robot, getting the best out of both human and machine. Doctors hope it'll lead to less invasive operations that allow patients to recover more quickly. Here's Ara Darzi of Imperial College London, part of the team developing the technology, talking to Guardian science correspondent James Randerson.
If you compare this system with the current practice of keyhole surgery, you see some tremendous advantages. Firstly, there's 6-degree freedom of movement on the instruments, where the laparoscopic instruments have 4-degree freedom of movement. And that hugely simplifies a very complex task in laparoscopic surgery, which is not tying and doing, you know, straightforward surgical procedures, which became very complicated in keyhole surgery in contrast to open surgery. But in robotics, it's made simplifies that by having a 6-degree freedom of movement. The second unique advantage of it is that when you are operating, you're actually getting a 3D image of the operative field. Now, that is what we were accustomed to in open surgery, but we went into laparoscopic surgery looking at television screens or monitors. We've lost that 3D into 2D. Now it's back in the robotic system. In the master station is a 3D. So these are the two main, very noticeable differences. The third, which is even more exciting, is the ability to damp the movements of the instrumentation, which is what we call the concept of motion scaling, where you actually, you move your hand 5 millimeters and you have the right algorithm, you can actually move the instrument at 1 millimeter. So what you're trying to do there is get a much more finer and more accurate movements, and it takes away the fine tremor during operative surgery, which we all have. And that makes it very relevant to microscopic type of surgery, whether it's microvascular, in other words, suturing very small blood vessels. The other very interesting concept we're doing is this concept of motion compensation. Now, when you operate on a patient, even when the patient is anesthetized, their heart is beating and they're also breathing. They're breathing because they're on a ventilator. Their heart is beating because you hope their heart continues to beat. Now, that motion does have an impact during surgery, especially in cardiac surgery. And one of the concepts, which is the gaze contingent perceptual docking, and this is probably the smartest thing we've come up with. What that does, it uses the surgeon's brain as a way in calculating the depth of the tissue. And the way you do that is that you measure the focal points, the fixation points, by looking at an image. And by tracking both eyes, you can measure the depth of the fixation point. And if you know the tissue characteristics of the tissue you're looking at, like the heart or the liver, you can then reconstruct movements in a way that you can actually get the scope to move at the same frequency as the beating heart. So you display to the surgeon a static image. The best way to describe this, if you're driving on the M1 beside a car, which is driving at the same speed as you are, you look out of the window, it looks static, unless you look at the floor. And that's exactly what we're doing. So we're essentially fooling the surgeons by showing them it's a static heart. Now, that has a huge advantage because you don't have to put the heart on a heart-lung machine.
And similarly, the tools that you're using are moving relative to the heart as well. So that
everything, the whole environment, the whole operative environment is moving at the same speed in relation to the organ that you're operating on.
Ara Darzi there with James Randerson. He's also a government health minister, by the way. Not James, obviously. Ara Darzi. Bobby, robots. You're a robot man. And would you want a robot?
I'm not a robot man. I'm a human.
I mean, a robot lover, I would say. Would you want a robot operating on you? You know, rummaging around inside?
Well, I think there's a difference between a completely autonomous robot and what these guys, Imperial, have come up with. Now, what they do have, it is really fascinating, you know, and Ara Darzi is one of the pioneers of keyhole surgery, and this is kind of taking things on many, many steps beyond. They slide this little bugger into you and he wriggles around and slices
that's
out.
That's true, obviously. I mean, keyhole surgery is kind of commonplace now, but it is essentially a robotic sort of technique.
Yeah, and what they're doing is extending this further inside the body in a slightly more autonomous way. And interestingly, I mean, this is one of the areas that Britain is now kind of forging ahead. In other areas of science and engineering, we're having trouble keeping up with our competitors. But here, you know, Darzi's team were recently given another grant to set up a kind of centre for robotic surgery at Imperial from the Hamlin Foundation, I think, millions of pounds. But we are really progressing quite fast with this. And, you know, it may not actually be that long, like with keyhole surgery, before it becomes relatively commonplace.
We're not thinking that, you know, there's going to be a robot sort of slicing you up and saying,
I think what's going to happen, you know, by the time you reach the grand old age of 35 or something, they're going to wheel in a huge robot with a saw on the end. He's just going to slice you to pieces.
Yeah, that's a bit worrying. So what happens if something goes wrong? I mean, who takes responsibility? I suppose the surgeon is still in charge.
The robot just goes, it weren't me, Gov. And that's it. He does a runner.
Going a bit mad.
Do they have to sign the Hippocratic Oath, though, the robots?
Who, the robots? Yeah. Some sort of version of that for robots might have to be
Robocratic Oath.
Let's leave that ridiculous conversation there. Look, back to Doug Melton now. You might have guessed from Doug's accent that he's from the US of A, where the stem cell debate is even more of a political hot potato than it is here in the UK. That's partly down to the influence of the religious right. And of course, since George Bush came into office, he severely curtailed federal funding of stem cell research. Will anything change with a new man or woman in the White House? Here's Doug Melton from the Harvard Stem Cell Institute once again.
First, let's remind ourselves why it's controversial. It's not because people have any special moral or ethical dilemmas about stem cells. It's really where they come from, where human embryonic stem cells come from. And it shouldn't be surprising that that creates a lot of interest and attention, because it reminds us all of sort of the mystery of life. I mean, the fact that a fertilized egg can make an animal or a person, I think, fascinates everyone from children in, you know, first grade on. This raises metaphysical questions about when human life begins or when a person begins. And that, of course, then brings in religion, which then adds in politics to the mix. And that's how we got to where we are. I think very reasonable people have different views about answering that question. And as you well know, most all religions either have a kind of constructive ambiguity about the answer or don't answer it at all. So in this country, it's come down to a political issue, which is not whether or not the work could go forward. If the work were morally and ethically wrong and should never happen, then it wouldn't be a question of how, of whether you pay you use federal funds or not. You would just say it shouldn't be done. So this nation has agreed that the work should go forward, but the question became whether or not one should use federal funds for it. More to your pointed question about whether this has slowed research in this country, the answer is unquestionably yes. We're very fortunate here at Harvard, through the Stem Cell Institute, to have the generosity, or to enjoy the generosity, of philanthropic donations from many of our alumni and others. And they decided to help us try to get this work started until federal funds will be available. We've never asked for any special treatment. All we've really ever asked for is that stem cell research could vie for federal funding the same way all other research does. It's not that we want a special set-aside. We just want it to be treated with an objective judgment about what, where are important discoveries about fundamental biology or medicine most likely to come. Implicit in the question is whether this present policy will stand now and forever. I think that's unlikely. It's hard for me to make predictions about discovery in science. It's even harder about who the next president. If you know the answer to that, then I could make an indication, I guess.
I mean, it's going to be one of a few likely candidates. But, I mean, none of them seem very, very sort of, they don't seem to have the sort of opposition to stem cells that George Bush had.
I don't actually know Senator McCain's views on the matter, nor have I heard any specific predictions from the Democratic candidates. So I think it's too early to tell.
Fascinating stuff. But sadly, that's all we have time for this week. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science for links to everything we've discussed in the show. You'll also find my full interview with Dr. Doug Melton there, where he really does give the true A to Z of stem cells and embryology. We're back same time, same place next week. Thanks to Bobby Johnson and everyone with their regional accents this week. In fact, you didn't have a regional accent, did you, Bobby? Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I'm Alok Jar.
And I drink your milkshake.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
I know what I drink your milkshake means. I haven't seen the film, but, you know.
Do we need to say more than I drink your milkshake? Because it just makes no sense.
And I've been drinking... I've been drinking
your milkshake.
I'm going to drink your milkshake.
And I've been drinking your brain milkshake.
Science Weekly.